Once again, we have another exciting segment of Reclaiming History.
Right here at 105.3 FM, the sanctuary for independent media.
I'm Lavonia Mallory. Today we have a very special guest. Dorothy Kim teaches medieval literature at Brandeis University. Her research focuses on race, gender, the digital humanities, medieval women's literature, culture, medievalism, Jewish and Christian differences, books of history, digital media, and the alt-right. She was the 2013-14 fellow at the University of Michigan Frankel Institute of Advanced Judaic Studies, where she drafted a monograph entitled Jewish-Christian Entanglements, Anchoring Wise and Its Material Worlds, which is forthcoming from the University of Toronto Press. She also has two books, The Alt Medieval Digital Whiteness and Medieval Studies, and Decolonize the Middle Ages, forthcoming from ARC Press. She is co-editing A Cultural History of Race in the Renaissance and Early Modern Age from 1350 to 1550 with Kimberly Coles, University of Maryland, College Park. Also is editing a special issue of Medieval Feminism Forum, a journal of gender and sexuality on medieval trans feminism. Dorothy Kim, welcome to another segment of Reclaiming History.
Thank you for having me, and I'm delighted to be on.
So there were Asian folks, African folks, going into Europe, trading with what we call Western Europe, Italy, Spain, France. These folks were crossing the waters and going back and forth into Europe. Was that really happening at that period?
Yes, because you have to think about the Silk Road from Asia. We also have evidence of archaeological digs where we have various kinds of material artifacts that are coming out of Asia that are being dug up in parts of Western Europe. We have this 12th century Islamic graves in France that were recently excavated that have been discussed as the first excavation of an Islamic community in Western Europe. If you think of it this way, before the Middle Ages, it is basically the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was wide and took up a lot of geography, and they liked to move people around. You know, they were these vast trade networks. For instance, the archaeological evidence out of Roman Britain that several of my classic colleagues have discussed make it really clear that London was a multiracial city in the Romano-British period. Why do we imagine that that changed all of a sudden when the Middle Ages happened? I think the thing to understand is that there was contact, there was lots of trade, but also people moving in and out. So my colleagues at York have a really lovely website about immigrants in the Middle Ages, and they have worked out the documents from a bunch of legal and other records, business records. And you can actually find where some of these immigrants are coming from. And they have immigrants in London coming from India in the 15th century. There's actually quite a number of Islamic immigrants. It's England's medieval immigrants. And it's sort of this database where you can actually look up where were these people moving from to England. So even somewhere as far western as England, where it was having this influx of various people and bodies from other parts of the world, the closer you are to the Mediterranean, the more straightforward that would have been. And I think people forget that Africa had, depending on which part of Africa, during what time period, there were clusters of really interesting civilization, what we think of as civilization, cultural centers. So you have Ethiopia, you have what's going on in Mali, you have Aksum in Eastern Africa. There's a bunch of stuff going on during the 500 to 1500 period. There's a new exhibit that is starting at Northwestern called Rivers of Gold that is also going to be shown in Toronto at one of the museums there. And then we'll eventually go to the National Museum of African American History in the Smithsonian. I think in the end of 2019, the beginning of 2020, that basically discusses this importance of Africa as a major trading and civilization location in the Middle Ages and how much wealth was actually being brought out of Africa into other parts of the world.
So you talk a lot about all of the research that's being done, and it sounds very exciting. How is the scholarly community receiving this, can I call it a more diverse view of history? How do your colleagues and other professors around the university system, this ivory tower, how do they receive this historical view of a very diverse medieval period?
I think it has been mixed. I think in one way, there is a willingness to think about these questions in relationship to widening the scope of the field, to think about a kind of global Middle Ages. But I also think there has been pushback in discussions related to methodology and what I would think of as decolonizing or anti-racist methodological and pedagogical practices in the field. So it's been mixed. There is definitely colleagues and people in the field who are ready to really push and break open this critical historical question, because I think at least a number of us realize that this is also a question about public history and public humanities and what is being sent out into the public universe about this medieval past, that it has a lot of political psych in relationship to it. But I think there's also some conflict about how that will be framed. Some colleagues are actually perfectly fine with a white supremacist medieval history. I mean, there are at least a handful of known white supremacist fascist medievalists that have identified themselves as such. So it's not as if we're all on the same page, if that makes sense, to kind of topple the ivory tower. I think it's a mixed thing. And I think the other thing is, it's interesting because some of that has become, for me, for the last couple of years, this sort of argument that gets pushed back on me about we can't discuss certain terminology or certain kinds of theoretical frames in the medieval past, which makes no sense to me because this is usually in relationship to, if I say we need to talk about these issues of race and the structures of race and how it was formed in the Middle Ages, I do get the pushback, particularly in medieval history circles, about, no, you can't talk about that because that's not actually historically accurate, because that wasn't a term that was used during the period. And it's interesting that they say these things to me, particularly when I bring up race, but they never say this to me when I say, oh, let's talk about medieval oncology, let's talk about engineering, or let's talk about the history of X and Y that doesn't have the kind of political attachments that the term race has.
So what you're saying is that when you talk about race within the medieval period, your colleagues are saying that race is a modern construct, and therefore it wasn't viewed the same way in that period, so we don't need to talk about it.
It's not just that they think it's anachronistic, it's also this idea that the pre-modern past is somehow pre-racial. They don't have to deal with these difficult issues related to race and racism and the transatlantic slave trade or the frame out of global empire and things like that. There's a couple of things going on there. They always push back by saying, oh, you should use the term ethnicity. We are not really addressing where we're getting this kind of terminology. And the pushback is really a pushback about the history of the field of history and social sciences and the history of the terms race, where in the late 19th, early 20th century North American historical studies, race was really imagined in biological ways. So it was a very eugenicist framing of the term race. And ethnicity was considered the better term to use because it meant that you could assimilate and become X or Y. This was where that terminology first got introduced into social science studies work. But then I think what my medieval historian colleagues have not addressed is that the 60s happens, the civil rights movement happens, and the call out from various politicized Black, Indigenous, people of color communities about the frames of assimilation and deciding that race is biological and eugenicist and not sociocultural factors as well as other things. And so the rest of the field of history dealt with the civil rights framing. The social sciences has moved to deal with what is now, 50 years of post-civil rights historical social science methodologies. Medieval historians have either willfully ignored or just have no clue that they're repeating the methodologies of a pre-civil rights and thus white supremacist historical social science methodology.
Dr. Kim, I can't believe it. We are out of time, but we've got to have you back on the show once again. To my listeners, make sure you tune in Dr. Kim, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.